From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea. Condoleezza Rice for vice president. Senator John McCain is putting together his short list of potential running mates, and some Washington insiders would like to see Rice as the number two on the ticket with McCain. Some say the Secretary of State would bring diversity and foreign policy know-how to the GOP ticket. Rice says she's eager to step out of the White House and back into academia, but speculation still looms large. So what would a McCain-Rice campaign look like? And how would one of the world's most powerful women do as America's second in command? Joining us now is Marcus Mabry, the author of Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, and conservative activist Grover Norquist. He heads Americans for Tax Reform, a grassroots taxpayer advocacy group. Norquist recently endorsed the idea of Rice as VP. Gentlemen, welcome to News and Notes.
Glad to be with you.
So, Grover, let me start with you. Now,
sure.
Some of this buzz about Rice as a possible VP candidate stems from her appearance at one of your regular breakfast gatherings for conservatives. So why was her visit important? And do you think that, obviously you do think that she would be a great VP. So tell us, first of all, about the visit, and secondly, your opinion about her.
Certainly. 2 weeks ago, she came and met with the Center-Right Coalition. It's a group of about 150 people get together for an hour and a half every Wednesday, and we go through about 30 different topics of conversation. Rice came and spoke for about 20 minutes, took 20 minutes of questions, and people walked out of that room saying two things. One, that she gave a very good explanation of what the administration's been doing, is trying to do, and where they've had successes and failures, much better than the president does. And second, that she'd be a good president herself. And obviously, since that the president job is on the Republican side is going to McCain, the vice presidency is the obvious option.
Is she a conservative of the stripe that you would like? Senator McCain has taken some heat from some conservatives for being not what they want. How do you view Rice's politics?
Rice has certainly made her mark as a foreign policy expert and strategist, and is in the mold of Ronald Reagan and peace through strength. Certainly, she has written a great deal on the Second Amendment and her belief that that was critically important to the civil rights movement in the South when she was growing up. And having worked with the folks at Stanford, she understands low taxes and economic growth, and certainly free trade and economic development.
I want to play something for both of you. Yesterday, I asked a couple of our political experts what they thought of a possible McCain-Rice ticket, and here is what Democratic strategist Donna Brazile had to say about Rice making a bid for the vice presidential slot.
First of all, she's not seeking it. She's not interested. She has indicated on numerous occasions that she is returning to academic life. I think Condoleezza Rice is a little bit tired of Washington, D.C. at this point in terms of when her service is over with. She hopes to return to private life again.
Now, Marcus, you wrote a biography about Rice, and you spoke to her for that biography. Based on what you know about her character, her attitude, her ambitions, do you think she's hedging right now around the VEEP issue, or is she really trying to get out of public life?
Well, one thing for Rice, she doesn't hedge. This is not a woman who hedges. She is a very resolute public personage, and she's a very resolute private personage. So she's not someone who's going to calculate and figure out, how do I strategize about this. One of the most amazing things about Rice, and one of the biggest surprises to me in doing the book and, spending 2.5 years researching her life and talking to her and her friends and family, and her critics, obviously, was the fact that Rice has actually never strategized to get any of the jobs she's had since she failed at her first choice for a career, which is being a concert pianist. Now, what's extraordinary is I'm not at all surprised, actually, that Donna Brazile would say, would poo-poo the idea, because if Rice is recruited, and if George W. Bush especially were to go to her and say, I'd like for you to join John McCain on the ticket, as Rice's stepmom, who's her closest living relative, says, because both her natural parents are gone. As her stepmom says, Rice has a hard, Condoleezza has a hard time saying no to that man.
Do you think that, from what you know, the president might at some point request her to step into that role or at least consider it?
Well, she'd be formidable. I think there's no question that, the Democrats would be in a lot more trouble, I think, if she was on that ticket, just because, not because Rice particularly brings stuff that McCain doesn't have. She's been in an executive branch, but, he has plenty of foreign policy experience, but she's a woman and African-American. In a year in which the Democrats are going to have one or the other at the top of their ticket, and potentially, although unlikely, both on their ticket. So Rice brings all that. Plus, no one would deny she's as qualified, as Hillary Clinton likes to say, to be president tomorrow. She's had 8 years in this White House. She's got 4 years in Washington before that. She is incredibly capable. And as Grover Norquist said, she's more articulate and better at saying what this administration has been trying to do than the president himself. So she'd be an extraordinary candidate. I don't think the president would go and ask unless John McCain decided that's what he wanted. And John McCain will only decide that, I think, once he sees what does he really need, who is his Democratic opponent, and what does he really need a vice president to accomplish. Does he need to shore up his social conservative base? And in which case, obviously, Rice would not be someone. Does he need to shore up his conservative fiscal base? Well, Grover Norquist is someone who comes from that side of the party, and I think you just heard very clearly that Rice would be an asset in that case.
Grover, let me go to some of this buzz. According to the Washington Post, political analyst Dan Senior really helped ignite the buzz, and he went on this week, and after he did, he got a bunch of messages and was quoted in the Post saying about half of those emails were from people saying, is it true? How can I help? Where can I sign up? Like I'm the call center for the Draft Condi movement. Is there really a Draft Condi movement? Is there that kind of a buzz around this?
Well, first of all, there has been one for a couple of years. I don't know how serious it is, but I see them at Republican and conservative events. They got lots of buttons. There's also a broad sense of support for her. It's not somebody that John McCain has to pick, but that she would certainly be one of five or six people that would complement him well, that could seriously run a campaign, that wouldn't have a Dan Quayle moment or a Spiro Agnew moment where the establishment press says, and what were you thinking? So I think that she brings many, many assets. And as pointed out, it's my hope that McCain will do a series of personnel announcements, such as, here's who will help me pick judges. Senator Graham of Texas would be my Secretary of Treasury. That would answer the questions that some economic conservatives have, some social conservatives have on policy, because personnel is policy. If McCain does that, and I think it makes sense, I think he will, then the vice presidency can be a more well-rounded person that doesn't have to fit, you know, a square peg into a round hole to get some particular voting block, but can actually be someone that appeals to the whole country.
This is for both of you, and I'll start with you, Grover. Do you think that Condoleezza Rice would either have or add crossover appeal for swing voters, Democrats who might want to vote for someone else, or independents?
I do, and it's for the following reasons. One of the successes that Obama had was that he came across as a post-racial guy, not Jesse Jackson, not Al Sharpton, not nursing grievances. And people want to sort of put racial antagonisms behind them, and voting for a candidate who's post-racial in that sense makes a lot of independents and other Americans feel good about themselves. Condi would add that to the Republican ticket.
Now, Marcus, I'm going to throw the same question to you with the added question of whether or not she would attract black voters. So swing voters, crossover voters, and black voters, any, none?
I think definitely some swing voters and some crossover voters. I think all the people who might be, say, right-thinking Democrats who believe that they'd like to help make history in November, if Rice is on that ticket, the Republican ticket, and without Rice, let's admit there will probably not be a woman or a person of color on that ticket if it's not her. So if Rice is on that ticket, then those right-thinking Democrats and those progressive-thinking Democrats can say, well, I can still make history and vote for the Republicans if for some reason they are uncomfortable with the Democratic nominee. And there are obviously many reasons to be uncomfortable with them. If one has the experience, if it's Obama and one has the experience tinkle about voting for him, then obviously you can vote for McCain and still make history if Rice is on the ticket. It will bring some black voters. I think it will probably bring older black voters, because in going around the country and talking about Rice to African Americans, what I found is there's a real division there. Most African Americans are divided amongst themselves, against themselves, about how they feel about Condoleezza Rice. They admire her strength. They don't admire the administration she's been a part of, and they think that she's often been cold, and some would even go as far as saying she's lied publicly. So there is a great deal of confusion, I think, in the black community about what we should feel toward her. But without a doubt, I think some older African Americans would vote for her. One thing that, you know, that the Republicans would probably, it'll be an amazing election if this were to happen. It's kind of a, you know, the dream election for us in the media. One thing that the Republicans would probably exploit is the fact that Rice's ancestors were slaves in this country, as well as slave owners, much as Barack Obama said of his wife, Michelle. Rice and Michelle Obama both are descended from American slaves. Barack Obama may be African American. However, he is not descended from those who were slaves in this country, and most of us African Americans are. So that is actually a tribute that Rice has, and the fact that Rice actually grew up in segregated Birmingham, Alabama. You know, there was no darker time in our racial history since slaves were freed than that time, and she came out of that time. And so I think that is really powerful.
Grover, just quickly, is the Republican Party going to try to recruit black voters and voters of color? It's been a bit of a back burner so far.
I think it's a very real option and possibility. Certainly Rice would be one of the strongest candidates to do that, and I think that's one of the assets she brings to the Republican Party and to the country.
Well, gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with conservative activist Grover Norquist, who heads Americans for Tax Reform, that's a grassroots taxpayer advocacy group, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times. He's also the author of Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power. He joined me from our NPR studios in New York. And just ahead, Elena Borneman wanted a new home so bad she could taste it. Then she won a contest from Black Enterprise magazine that helped her take the next step. I'll talk with Elena and an editor from Black Enterprise. They'll explain how you can make your dreams of owning your own place come true. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. As Luther Vandross would say, a house is not a home, but buying a house is often the first step not only towards feeling settled, but also towards building the financial security to live out your dreams. That dream, however, has soured for many people who've been caught up in mortgage lending troubles and others who feel they're being shut out of being able to buy. So how do you get a house and keep it? With us today is Trevor Delaney. He's the personal finance director and editor at Black Enterprise magazine, and Elena Borneman of Clearwater, Florida. She made a firm plan to own a home, and as a bonus, that plan helped her win Black Enterprise's Own Your First Home contest. So Trevor and Elle, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So, Elle, let's talk about this contest. You were awarded $10,000 as down payment money towards a house in this Black Enterprise contest back in October of last year. So what made you decide to enter, and how did you find out you'd won?
Well, I was at a point in my life where I had been working on preparing myself for mortgage readiness for about 2 years, and I felt that it was an opportunity where I could really take the next phase of my life through home ownership and actually set some long-term financial goals and build wealth for my family. And I came across the article that was listed in Black Enterprise, and I just entered in. I decided to give it a shot, and they basically asked people to write essays based on what home ownership meant to them, And I gave a very heartfelt explanation of what it meant to me and why it was so important for me and my family.
I'm actually going to ask you to read us a little bit of your essay explaining why you wanted to buy a home. And also, you know, we'll talk more about this, but you had plans in place already. So can you read us a little bit?
Sure. There's a particular piece in my essay where I am giving a visual of a certain time in my life when I was very young. And here it is. By the time Victoria and Elizabeth were two, those are my twin daughters, I relocated us to Washington, D.C. We lived in Southeast D.C., the most inner city project area, on Jasper Street, right next to the 7th District Police Station. Nothing but drug dealers, gunshots, and ambulance hummed through the streets at night. That first year was the coldest winter ever. I remember it being so cold that tears would freeze on my cheeks.
It's powerful, and you wanted and have gotten better for yourself. What did you do? I mean, a lot of us have dreams. Some of us accomplish them. It sounds like you put certain things in place. What did you do?
Well, at that point, that was about 8 years ago, I really started trying to focus on developing my professional career so that I could increase my income, which is very important when banks are looking at debt to income ratio. So any opportunity that I got for professional development, I really jumped on it. And those opportunities led to constant relocations in and around the metropolitan area in the state of Florida. But I was very lucky to have some amazing leaders that wanted to transfer intelligence and really teach me the areas that I wanted to learn in. So my first step was really to increase my income, whether it was working one or two or three jobs at a time.
Well, we'll get back to more of your planning, but I want to go to Trevor. When you hear Elle, you obviously are hearing a woman who has a lot of determination and a lot of knowledge. Why did you start this contest? And what are the range of approaches that people have when they tell you why they really want to buy a home?
Well, the contest was started actually 3 years ago. Elena is the winner of our third contest, and it was founded really because home ownership is so vital in terms of building wealth. Home ownership really accounts for about a third of household net worth, according to the census. So it really is sort of a key part of the overall equation. Her essay jumped out at us out of more than 1,000 entrants, and I think, as you pointed out quite accurately, her essay goes on, and it's very vivid in terms of really demonstrating the commitment that she has. And the range of essays, there were some that were certainly on par in terms of really demonstrating the commitment that somebody has and an understanding of its importance to an overall plan. But I just think her overall seriousness and sort of dedication to trying to do this for her two young daughters really is what sort of drove us to select her.
I'm assuming that when you run this contest, you have a philosophy that says that people who enter and don't get the money are still winners because they've tried to present themselves in a frame of mind that allows them to move forward. What do you offer people who don't win? Once you publish the results and once you give your tips, what kind of advice do you give to people who may not be getting $10,000 but who still want to buy that home?
Right. You touch upon a key area. I mean, it is sort of almost the winner is almost a secondary purpose. I think the primary purpose really of the contest is sort of spreading the knowledge about home ownership and having folks understand its importance and really the role that it can play in not just their own building of wealth, but a key initiative here at Black Enterprise is really sort of getting the Black community to understand intergenerational net worth and passing on what folks have been able to achieve. So I think really that is sort of the key message of the contest.
Elle, why don't you take us to the plan that you generated? You actually sat down and you came up with an actual plan for how to save money. You say that earning more was a big first step, but a lot of people always increase their expenses to whatever they're earning. So if you make $5,000 more next year than you did this year, you buy that new TV, you increase, this, that, or the other. I assume that you made some other choices. What were they?
Oh, absolutely. It's, making a financial plan that works with your life plan is a challenge, and it's got to be something that you have to be completely dedicated to. For me, I didn't have a lot of money to save at the end of the day, so frugal spending was very important. Really strict budgeting, and when I set the plan or set the goal or set the budget, I stuck to it. Anywhere from, cutting out coupons to just being really aware of what type of community resources were out there, and education was out there for me to tap into to improve upon my plan.
Where did it hurt the most? Let's just be real here. Like, what did you miss the most when you decided to get kind of strict with yourself?
Probably the most difficult part was socializing. I think that we spend a lot of money going places to fill up our time, spending money at shopping malls. You know, I think that oftentimes we just spend when we don't have to. And there are different things that, you know, triggers that I've come to learn that create those type of spending situations. So I really focused on my developing inner strength and relationships with my family and closest friends, because a lot of times I think people will spend money when they're upset or when they're really happy or when they're lonely. And I really took that time in my life to repair and mend the relationship with my mother, my father, and then just really be as strong and as active in my daughter's lives as I possibly could.
And
you know, whether it was, you know, being involved in school or after school programs or curriculum.
And you were someone who had your twins earlier than you might have otherwise planned.
Absolutely.
And had to sort of hit the ground running.
Yes.
Well, in case you're just tuning in, we are continuing our housing series with a look at home ownership. And this, of course, is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're hearing from Elle Borneman. She's recently bought her first home and was the recipient of the third annual Own Your First Home contest by Black Enterprise. And Trevor Delaney, the personal finance director and editor at Black Enterprise magazine. Trevor, give us a few step-by-step items of what you need to do when you want to be mortgage ready, which is a term that Elle just used.
Right.
And then give us a set of steps when you are ready to start looking.
Okay, well, I think the first thing that folks need to recognize is that the home ownership process is just that, that it takes, you really should plan for about a year at least to sort of position yourself and get yourself mortgage ready. And that a key first step is really understanding where you're at in terms of your credit rating. You can go to annualcreditreport.com and get a free credit report. Now, that's different than your credit score. You'll have to pay a small fee to get your credit score, but you want to look at both. Your credit report will reflect all of your charge cards, you know, mortgage loans, car, not your mortgage loan, excuse me, but your car payments, any delinquencies, that kind of thing. And you want to give that close scrutiny so that you can make any corrections and have that impact your score. And then you want to look at your score because that will influence the rate that you can get on your mortgage. So you want to start by taking a look at that and then making any corrective actions that you might need to. Then start building your down payment. A simple way to do that for folks who are starting from scratch is to get an automatic deduction from your checking account and move it to one of the online banks and slowly accumulate some funds that you might then turn into CDs to earn a higher interest rate. You want to keep it relatively liquid.
Well, let me just stop you because you're using some terms.
Okay.
CDs, certificates of deposit,
liquid
meaning money that you can get out without paying a lot of penalties.
Right.
So it sounds like the plan is to, you know, to start saving the money and then to try to put it someplace where you can earn some interest.
Right. A lot of folks, it surprisingly, make the mistake of just sort of having it sit at a very low interest rate in a checking account. And that poses two problems. One, it's not working for you. And then if it's right in your checking account, it's all too easy to dip into when you have that unexpected leaky faucet, what have you.
So say that you've reached the point where you are saving regularly, you have enough money for a down payment, your credit score is good enough to get a good loan and not just a loan that will be exorbitant. When you start looking, or as you start looking, what are some of the things you should keep in mind?
Well, one of the things I think a lot of homeowners don't really explore are the home buying programs in their area. if they go to the Department of Housing and Urban Development website, HUD.gov, they can find links to local programs in their state that offer assistance, particularly to first-time home buyers, but home buyers in general in terms of educating them about the process. And that may offer some additional financial guidance as well as just understanding the process. And they really need to understand who the key players are in terms of what are the interests of their real estate agent, in terms of being driven by a commission or what have you, making sure that they have a quality lawyer to guide them through the process and can really protect their own interests, and have working with a financial professional, a banker, to really understand their mortgage, which is sort of the key thing we've learned out of this whole subprime situation, is that folks really didn't understand what the adjustable rate mortgage would mean on a bottom line basis month to month, that, you know, my mortgage would payment would go up $300 and $400 a month or whatever the case may be.
Elwin, you bought your first home, and tell us, first of all, tell us about your home. What is it like to be in your own home?
It's complete security. You know, that's what it really translates to, and in a place where me and my family can start building a future long term. It's a special place, and I've always tried to make a home wherever we are, but this just makes a big difference in our lives.
When you went in to look at mortgages and to sign papers, what did you look for, and were there any moments at which you felt, you know, I don't really know what's going on here? And if that happened, what did you do?
Well, having been in the home ownership industry for about 6 or 7 years, I've had an opportunity by working with the HUD counseling agencies that Trevor just mentioned. I've had an opportunity to help hundreds of people realize the American dream. So having taken people step by step through that process, I was at an advantage and knew what I needed to do and who I needed to speak with to actually, you know, move from one step to the next. Basically, I contacted several different lenders that I had worked with in the past with previous clients to start shopping a mortgage and to see which mortgage product was most conducive with my financial needs and would help make that purchase the most affordable. I was also involved in the first-time homebuyer down payment assistance program in Pinellas County and City of Clearwater and City of Largo. So I contacted the individuals there and let them know that I was going to be interested in getting a down payment assistance loan, so that I knew that that would also help the actual purchase to create some more affordability.
Well, and let me just jump in here.
Uh-huh.
What is a down payment assistance loan? Sounds intriguing and helpful.
Absolutely. Throughout the United States, local municipalities, through their SHIP and home dollars, will offer first-time home buyers an opportunity to get assistance through a down payment assistance loan. And depending on where you are, there are different criteria based on your income and family size, the price of the home, and repayment. In my case, I have I received a $10,000 down payment assistance loan, which went towards my down payment. And as long as I do not sell that home, I will not ever have to repay that. So it's like a soft second mortgage, which was helpful in layering the finances to create the most affordable situation.
Well, there's plenty of good advice that both of you have given us, and there's a lot more to talk about. We'll continue to talk about it in our housing series. Trevor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elena Borneman is the recipient of the third annual Own Your First Home contest by Black Enterprise magazine, and Trevor Delaney is the personal finance director and editor at Black Enterprise. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's sports time, and Tony Cox is our guide. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
So protests over China's human rights record have slowed down the Olympic torch in London, Paris, and yesterday in San Francisco. So there's a chance some countries could boycott. Wouldn't be the first time, would it?
No, it would not. For example, President Carter kept the U.S. out of the 1980s Summer Games in Moscow. Then the Soviets retaliated by refusing to come to L.A. for the Summer Games in 84. As it stands, most of the talk so far is about boycotting the opening ceremony and not the games, which is topic number one for today's Sports Bloggers Roundtable. Here to talk more about the boycott and other sports stories are Dee Will of the blog Sports on My Mind, also Marcus Vandenberg, senior producer and author of BET sports website Play a Hater, and Kevin Figures of AM570Radio.com, Los Angeles, an all sports station. Welcome, fellas.
How you doing, Tony?
Doing great, thank you. Great. Let's start with this. As I mentioned, the Olympic torch has set off a firestorm because of international furor over what critics see as China's heavy-handed tactics against Tibet. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton are calling for President Bush to boycott the opening ceremony in Beijing. The president has signaled his opposition to a boycott, but whether that changes, we'll have to see. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he is not going to the opening ceremony, and on it goes. So, Dee Will, what about the athletes? Traditionally, they are against boycotts, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Generally, most of the athletes, for most of the athletes, the Olympics is the pinnacle of their career. They've trained 4 years for these events, and boycotting would be the last thing on their minds because this is their chance to finally show how good they are as athletes. Also, it's in the Olympic Charter. It's stated in the Olympic Charter that athletes should have no displays of political sentiment at all. So that compounds the issue for them.
Well, for the Americans, Kevin, this was supposed to be the year they redeemed themselves, you know, in basketball after their very poor showing 4 years ago. This is a showcase event. What do you think someone like Kobe Bryant and the rest of the team will do? Will they keep quiet or will they push to go ahead?
I'm pretty sure they'd push to go ahead. And you look at the guys, as what Diwa was saying earlier, how these people worked so hard to get here for so long. And Brian Colangelo, when he put the team together, made this a 3-year commitment for all these players. And so they played in the Olympic qualifiers last summer. And I'm sure none of those guys, especially Kobe Bryant and Carmelo Anthony, who are such tough competitors, don't want all that to go for naught. So I'm sure they want to go out and they want to display their talents and bring America basketball back to what it was back when they had the dream team, when they were winning all the championships and blowing people off the floor.
And they haven't done that in a long time, have
they? No, they haven't.
That's for sure. Marcus, let me bring this to you, because do you think that the experience of Mexico City, even though it was 40 years ago, still resonates with black Olympic athletes when it comes to protests? Because John Carlos and Tommy Smith paid a price for their black glove-fisted demonstration on the victory stand. Are times different now, though?
I think times are different now. You're talking about 1968 when the country as a whole was racially charged. And now we're 2008, you know, things aren't great in America, but as a country, you know, as, you know, across the world, I think we have different issues that we're focusing on. Personally, I don't think any athletes are going to make a protest in that sense, mm-hmm. Something to that, you know, that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a sports fan, I would hope that, you know, the protest carry up until August 8th, and then once August 8th rolls around, that we can focus about the events itself. And, you know, when August 24th rolls around and closing ceremonies happen, then we can focus back on the protests.
All right, we'll wait and see what's going to happen. Let's move on. Topic number two. The NCAA Men's Championship wrapped up earlier this week. You guys know the results. How will that affect the NBA draft? I'm going to come with you, D. Will, first, because especially how will it affect those players who have to declare soon whether they are staying or leaving for school? For example, we've got USC's Kevin Mayo, Kansas State's Michael Beasley certain to jump, tournament sensation Stephen Curry from Davidson says he's staying put. The 7-foot twins from Stanford are going. The Lopez brothers, Dante Green from Syracuse is going. UCLA's Kevin Love isn't saying what he's going to do. And there are many more facing this hard decision. What about looking at it this way, D. Will? Who ought to go, in your opinion?
In my estimation, very few players ought to go. Derrick Rose, I feel, is one of the players who can go. O.J. Mayo is physically good enough. Mentally, I'm not really sure. I think there are a few things that he could do with his game to develop. Kevin Love, if he develops physically more, I think he'd be more ready for the NBA, being a tweener. Fortunately for NBA players, if they hire an agent, then they must declare for the draft. If they don't hire an agent, then they can bow out before the draft, and that's a good thing. So players can assess their situations, see where GMs might want to pick them, and make a decision based on that. And so that bodes well for a lot of the players.
For a lot of these guys, Kevin, all the changes could make for a drastically different field for next year's March Madness. I think you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
Which college program stands to be impacted the most by who goes or who stays?
I'd definitely say UCLA. If they lose their starting center and their starting point guard, especially a guy as good as Kevin Love, and Darren Collison, who even Ben Howland came out last night and said even if he were to come back, he wouldn't be the starter. Russell Westbrook would. But still, as a senior leader on that team, I can't express enough how important that would be. And Kevin Love, going into the NBA, I don't know sure if he would be ready yet. Just physically, he doesn't really have a lot of physical strength. You know, he's undersized, like I believe Debo said, he's a tweener. But coming back in a college game, I think another year would help him definitely, and it would definitely help the UCLA program. With Kevin Love, they're another Final Four team next year. Without him, they might not make the Sweet 16.
Well, you know, Marcus, we've got the 19-year-old age rule in the NBA, the one and done for NBA picks now going into its second year, that rule is. Is it changing things very much, do you think?
I think it is. It's changed sort of the makeup of the college game. College basketball is a lot more exciting. Now that players have to at least spend 1 year playing in collegiate ball. Some guys actually stay more than 1 year. I would love to see the rule increase to be 20 and older just to get some of these guys back. Could you imagine if O.J. Mayo had to return to USC with Davon Jefferson, if Kevin Love had to return to UCLA with Darren Collison? I think it would just, you know, bring more of a dynamic to college basketball and also help these guys when they're ready for the NBA.
Well, you know, you might be right about that, but it certainly would not help the Miami Heat or the Los Angeles Clippers or the Minnesota Timberwolves who are waiting for these guys to come out so they can sign them. Let's move on to topic number three. This is football. Here's an NFL headline story this week. Players union boss Gene Upshaw is on the firing line. Matt Stover of the Baltimore Ravens is challenging Upshaw for the top spot in the Players Association, with the argument being that Upshaw may be more of a company man, read that, NFL, than a union man. So, D. Will, what kind of support does Stover have?
I think there is a groundswell to oust Gene Upshaw. At the same time, Upshaw is, yes, in some respects, he is definitely a company man. In other respects, he's done great things for the players. And I'm coming to understand that it's a fine balancing act to be the head of the NFLPA. And so whomever is the head of that association is going to have a very, very tough time. And with the collective bargaining agreement talks coming up here soon in the next couple of years, I think it's very important that Upshaw does stay in place.
Now, they're trying to get him out by 2009, Kevin. Can they do that?
I don't think they should do that. Upshaw is the man with experience. He is the one person who has a great understanding of all the issues. Whomever would take his place would be a new person and subject to bullying by the owners.
You know, you took that away from Kevin, Deezer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's
all right.
That's okay, though.
It's all right.
Kevin, what do you say about that?
I'm just saying that, I mean, for the best thing, just like I agree with D. Will, that for stability, Upshaw needs to stay in it. Upshaw has already come out and said, I'm not leaving until this labor dispute is over with. And I believe what Stover, his entire angle on this is, like, I'm not trying to necessarily push Upshaw out the door. I'm trying to make sure that us as a union and as players have a representative to follow him up once he does want to retire and leave out, because they know it's going to happen sooner rather than later.
All right. Tell you what, Marcus, I'm going to move on to another topic with you, and I'm going to give you the first shot at it, and it's this. In golf, all eyes are on Augusta and Tiger Woods for the next 4 days, where Tiger is trying to win four major tournaments in the same calendar year. The Masters, step one, of course. We know he can do it. He's won, what, four times, five? But will he do it again this year? That's the question. And the pressure is really on, and some of it comes from Tiger himself, Marcus, who seems to really want this bad.
I think Tiger will do it. Considering if the weather is not a major factor this weekend, I think Tiger, hands down, will walk away with his fifth green jacket. You know, I think a lot of these golfers are just intimidated of him at this point. He's done so well. He's won 9 out of his last 11 tournaments since last year. So I think he's really reached the peak of his game. So
You think he's going to do it? Well, D. Will, if he doesn't do it, let's say, if lightning doesn't strike twice, does that change his quote-unquote standing in the pantheon of golf greats in any way?
No, he's got so long to go before his legacy is written. I don't think that winning or losing this Masters in 2008 makes that much of a difference. And golf is a very odd sport in that anyone can get hot for these 4 days and strike lightning themselves and win the green jacket.
You know, the LA Times today, Kevin, had a front page story about other golfers in the Masters, and it suggested, just as Marcus suggested, that these guys are afraid of going up against Tiger Woods. Do you think they really are?
Absolutely. I would be. I mean, this guy is unbelievable. This is the last guy I want to see on a golf course. He's basically the Michael Jordan of golf. He's the guy, if there's a clutch putt that needs to be made or anything that needs to be done, Tiger Woods is the one guy that you want to do it because you know he'll always come through. That's the last guy I'd want to see in a playoff or any kind of close situation in a golf tournament.
It will be really interesting to see. All right, last topic for the day, guys, is this. NBA MVP. I heard Tommy Heinsohn say on a Celtics broadcast the other day, couldn't believe it, that Kobe Bryant and LeBron James' names shouldn't even be on an MVP list this year, and that it should only be Kevin Garnett and, to his mind, Paul Pierce as well. So here's the question, guys. Kobe Bryant, LA Lakers, LeBron James, Cleveland, Kevin Garnett from Boston, Chris Paul from New Orleans. Everyone has their favorites this season. I'm going to come to all three of you really quickly. Is there anyone who should not be on that list? You first, D. Will.
No, they should all be on there. One addition, Tracy McGrady.
Tracy McGrady, that's interesting. Marcus, what do you say? Anybody should not be on that list?
No, I think they all should be on the list. And if I had a vote, it would go for Kobe Bryant.
Okay, that's good. Kevin, what do you say?
They should all be on the list. I agree. My vote would go for Chris Paul.
Chris Paul. Why Chris Paul over Kobe?
Well, for looking at the talent that both rosters have, and Chris Paul, a guy like Tyson Chandler, who was basically run out of Chicago with pitchforks, he's turned him into an all-star. David West, people were talking about him being a first-round bust into his second year, made him into an all-star. Whereas Kobe Bryant has an established roster with guys like Odom and Gasol, and Bynum, he came through early this season. If you took Chris Paul off of the Hornets roster, they wouldn't be a playoff team this year.
There's the answer, folks. D. Will, thank you very much. Marcus Vandenberg, thank you very much as well. And Kevin Figures, all on our Sports Bloggers Roundtable. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Tony.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tony.
And that was NPR's Tony Cox. And now, time to read your letters. Here to lend a hand is NPR producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, Farai. How you doing?
I am good. What's up with letters?
Well, last Friday, we commemorated the 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. We ran a story that featured voices from different political experts and scholars reflecting on the day King was killed. Here's how author and theologian Michael Eric Dyson remembered that day.
I was sitting in front of the television watching the regular program when the newsman interrupted and in a kind of somber monotone announced that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot in Memphis, Tennessee. And behind me, my father ejaculated this, you know, as if someone had punched him in the gut, an involuntary verbal response that testified to the magnitude of that news.
Letitia Thomas heard that one up in Buffalo, New York, and she wrote to say this. Normally, I can tolerate Professor Dyson's verbal pretentiousness, but he needs a serious whooping for his telling of his Dr. King assassination remembrance. Dyson shared his father's reaction, saying, "Behind me, my father ejaculated this oomph." That word choice was uncalled for. Dr. Dyson needs to go somewhere and sit down with a thesaurus.
And on Monday, I spoke with Marine Major General Walter Gaskin, one of the highest-ranking African-Americans in the U.S. military. Gaskin headed the 25,000-member multinational forces west. He returned home earlier this year. Brad Patu listened in from San Francisco and sent us this note. I can't believe you did not challenge the validity and credibility of General Gaskin's rah-rah statements on the Iraq War. General Gaskin is obviously a mouthpiece for the Bush administration and its policies. His denial of the real situation in Iraq, as they are presented by the overwhelming majority of witnesses, was breathtaking. Generally, I think you do an excellent job of asking tough questions of your interviewees. However, you gave General Gaskin a free ride. What was up with that? Well, Brad, thanks for the letter. I don't think I gave General Gaskin a free ride. And if you listen to some of the other folks we've had on, as you obviously have, they include Donna Shalala, Delbert Spurlock, individual service people and veterans. We definitely opened the door to people who have different and sometimes highly critical perspectives on the war.
And last week we heard from Dr. Leslie Stewart. She talked about the extraordinary prevalence of uterine fibroids in black women. Annette Austin in Fayetteville, North Carolina, tuned in, and Annette writes, "The segment with Dr. Stewart was extremely informative. I'm an African-American female in my mid-30s, and I've had one large mass removed surgically. I'm on the verge of having another procedure in an eight-month time frame. Knowing your options enables you to be better equipped to deal with this issue. Thanks for talking about it."
Here's a letter from listener Spencer Quinn about the tone of News and Notes. "I love NPR and listen to it religiously, but every time I hear your program, I just want to scream. It seems like it's just one big forum to talk about how much it sucks to be African American in our society. Maybe there are some difficulties, but can we hear some positives too? I am also a member of a minority group, but I don't define myself by my minority status. I just get along with my life." Well, Spencer, we are glad you wrote, and part of our mission is to focus on issues that other media generally don't. As a result, we examine issues of race, equity, disparity a lot. So are we whining or just telling the truth? That's up to you and other listeners to decide. That said, you'll also hear plenty of stories that fall into categories like news you can use, history, and stories of success and triumph. If you have something you want to hear us cover, just drop us a line.
And finally, this one from Paris Hatcher in Atlanta. "I love News and Notes. However, it seems like for the last three or four Thursday listener feedback responses, only the stories of white folks and non-black folks who love the show are read. It sounds and feels that attempts are being made to substantiate how great the show is because unassuming white folks listen to it. Let's hear the feedback from brothers and sisters."
Thanks for that letter, Paris. You know that News and Notes has fam from San Diego to Spain, even Japan. And when we get the love, we talk about it no matter where or who it comes from. In my opinion, we get a lot of interaction on our blog from our black listeners, but not quite as much in letters. That's just my perspective. So if you want your voice heard, give us a shout.
Well, brothers and sisters, that's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us, and be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. So, Christopher, thanks.
Farai, my sister, anytime.
Brothers and sisters, I don't know what this world is coming to.
Yes. That's our show for today, and thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, an update on Zimbabwe's ongoing election crisis. Plus, we'll hear how South Florida's Haitian community is responding to the news of deadly food riots on the island.
Yo, you got this money.